This is the Medicast, December 24th, 2007. Merry Christmas.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 98. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's podcast. It has been a wonderful 2007 as I look back at the year, and I'm going to do a little bit more of that later on in the show, but I want to thank everybody for contributing to the Medicast, for staying subscribed, for showing other folks the podcast, and for all of the things that has made this great Medicast community what it has become over the last year or so. And I want to just extend a big thank you to everybody for that. If you're a brand new listener to the Medicast, I want to welcome you personally to the Medicast program, whether you've been forwarded an email with a link to the Medicast, or if you found the site on your own and you're listening to a couple of the episodes, go ahead and check out the rest of the Medicast site. There's a way to search right there in the left-hand side. You can search the site as well as search the web. And when you search the Medicast site, you can find past episodes, links to tips and tricks, and different things that have been put up there, studies, links to news items, all kinds of information. There are nearly 500 different articles now posted on the Medicast blog, so it's likely you're going to find me referring to something about what you're looking for. At least I hope so. And if not, I want you to get in touch with me and let me know what it is you're looking for. Maybe I can feature it in a future episode of the Medicast. But whatever, I want to welcome you again as a brand new listener to the show, and I hope that you begin to contribute and let me know what you want to hear here in the future on the Medicast. For all of you long-term listeners, of course, you know what I'm talking about, and you all have been a great supporters of the show in all of the ways that you've done so. Your voicemail comments, your email comments, even your corrections when I've made errors, all have been valuable here to make the Medicast community a great place for EMS providers of all kinds to come and find information that they're looking for to make them better in the field. This will be the last episode of 2007. I'm going to take a week off, a much-needed week off, and get reorganized, get some things done here with the family at the end of the year. So there will be no episode next week on the 31st of December, New Year's Eve. So I'll be taking this week off to spend the holidays with my family, as well as wrap up some of my duties with my fire company as I pass the reins over as EMS chief to a new individual there. And so I have to get some things wrapped up there, as well as get ready for a new semester of school and all of the great things I have planned for 2008 with the Medicast. And so this is going to be it for 2007. We've had a great year, and we're looking forward to approaching both episode 100 and our big giveaway show on episode, I guess it's going to be 101 or 102, which will be the first episode in February. That'll be our two-year anniversary. 2 years ago, in 2006, the first week in 2006 in February, we actually began the Medicast. And if you want to listen to how the show's grown, how I've expanded the content of the show and polished it a little bit, you can go ahead and listen to that first episode. Go back in the podcast link on the Medicast site, and you'll find links to all of the old episodes, including Old Rusty Episode 1. So you can go check it out for yourself. I'm going to jump right on into this week's listener emails, and I got quite a few, but I'll pick a few of the better ones here, and I want to start off with listener Kelly. Listener Kelly from California has been helping out another of our listeners. And this is what I talk about when I say that this is a great community of people here at the MedicCast. We had a listener a little while ago who had requested some information on audiobook versions of the textbooks that they're using in their EMT classes and their paramedic classes. And this is something that I hadn't been able to find anywhere. Well, listener Kelly sent me an email that she spent time scanning the pages of her textbook into a computer and then using a text-to-voice computer program to actually convert the text of her textbook into a voice program. So she was able to do that. That's just one way. I hadn't even really thought about doing that, but what a great idea. So if you want some more information on that, maybe what I'll have to do is, Kelly, if you're listening out there, maybe we'll have to set up an opportunity to talk. I know we had chatted by phone once already, but maybe we can chat again and you can kind of give some pointers of how you scanned and what kind of software you used to interpret the text into a voice that could be played as an audio file and listened to while we're going down the road. Kind of build your own podcast. What a great idea. And again, just this is what the listeners are out there for. They give me ideas that I don't think of. They share ideas with you guys. And that's so if you have a question, if I can't answer it, I bet one of the other listeners can. So send your questions in here. And Kelly, thank you very much for sharing that great idea. The next email I received came in from listener Sean, who is from Edmonton, Canada, and he is talking about or referring to an article I looked at in the news about using telemedicine. And this is a topic I look at quite a bit whenever it pops up on my radar here when I'm searching for news items and articles to talk about on the show. One of the things I'm really keen on is the ways that we can use technology to further improve our patient care in the field. And telemedicine is one of those things that can be done to improve patient care. There often aren't enough ALS providers to go around, but you know, anybody can learn to apply EKG leads. And if you don't have a paramedic available, but you've got the ability to put on 12 lead EKG leads in the field and transmit the strip to a cardiologist at a hospital somewhere else in the world even, you can provide some better care. You can at least be able to get a diagnosis from a physician who calls back in on your med radio or your cell phone or whatever and lets you know, yeah, this patient needs to be diverted to STMI center, you know, a STEMI center, where you have better access to things like cath lab and other medications and treatments that may be available for this patient. All these things can be found by using telemedicine to get an advanced diagnosis ahead of time before you get to the ER. If nothing else, you have a physician who's better prepared to treat the patient they have coming in. So, Sean, I want to thank you very much. They use some form of the telemedicine process in Edmonton. Sounds like you guys are ahead of the curve up there, and that's good to hear. So keep the good news coming. Let me know, and we'll be able to find out more about this as you guys let me know, and I can pass it on to the other listeners. And Sean, thank you very much for contributing to the MedicCast. Since we're in Canada, I'll wrap up the listener email with an email I got from a good friend of the show, John Bignall of EMSLive.com. EMS Live's been on a bit of a hiatus as they've retooled their site, redesigned some things, and I finally have gotten the word from John and been over and taken a look myself at some of the great new changes that they have produced over at EMSLive.com. They have set up a site over there where you can publish your own EMS information and make it available for others to review, for others to use and look at. And even John even has a way over there for sharing some of the income that might be derived if you can produce good site traffic by generating a good and well-reviewed article over at emslive.com. And this goes for text articles as well as video and audio podcasting support. So John has just come up with some great ideas over there, and I know that this is only going to get better, and he has assured me that after the first of the year, they will be reviving the EMS Live podcast as well. And I'm going to be talking to John, hopefully, get him here on an interview, and we can talk a little bit about what prompted his changes and what he's looking to produce up there in Canada for everyone worldwide in the EMS field. I'm really excited about it. I've signed on to help author some articles up there on the site, and I'm really excited about being affiliated with John's site. So head on over to emslive.com and check out some of the things that are there for yourself, and maybe you might have something you're passionate about you'd like to do a little research on and produce an article of your own to contribute to the rest of the EMS community. A great way to do that over at emslive.com. Okay, I'll move on into the show and get to the link of the week this week. And I'm going to link again to the upcoming episode of the MedicCast Live podcast. We had a great time talking about patient refusals and really dug into a lot of different things that I hadn't even thought about when I looked at patient refusals, and had some great support from Rick Rosati, Eric Augustus, Chris Black, and others who really helped bring the show around and look at it from many different directions. So guys, I want to thank you for that. The next episode is going to be looking forward to what we're planning for EMS in 2008. What do you have going on in your service that you're excited about in the coming year? What changes do you look forward to? And what changes do you think need to be made that aren't going to get done in 2008? We're going to be talking about all of that in the very first MedicCast Live of the new year on January 8th. That's a Tuesday night, a week after New Year's, and we'll be talking about 2008 in EMS, what we're looking forward to. So you can tune in over at talkshoe.com and find the MedicCast Live podcast. You can go directly to MedicCastLive.com, and that'll tell you all about how to sign up for free at talkshoe.com. And you can sign up for a free account and then listen live, chat live, and call in live to get your opinion heard, ask your questions, and add your commentary, all at the MedicCast Live coming up here in January. We've got a fun-filled year. I've already scheduled the first two or three episodes because we have so much good content to cover in the MedicCast Live, and maybe we'll double up. Maybe we'll add another episode in the middle of the month and maybe make it a twofer. I don't know. We'll have to look at that in the new year, but the MedicCast Live is a great way for you to contribute back and get your viewpoint heard here on the MedicCast. I'm going to move on now into this week's EMS news, and we'll take a look at some of the things that have been going on in the recent time of EMS. And first off, I'd like to really look at a great idea that I uncovered. And this is a story out of Indiana University, and they're building a new medical simulation center. And one of the things they've done is taken an old ambulance body, and they've actually used a crane and built it into the new facility that they're putting together there, where they're going to use the inside of the ambulance shell to recreate an EMS work environment for people to practice in. What a fantastic idea. I've talked about these type of ambulance simulators before, but this is even, I don't know, this is even a better idea than just building one from scratch. If you know of an old ambulance out there, or maybe you know of a nearby company or your own company that's selling an ambulance, you might want to propose to your local community college, your local university, your local training center that maybe we should take that ambulance or at least the box body on the back of the ambulance and put it into service as a training center, as a trainer. I mean, all the cabinets, all the equipment, all of the stuff is all right there. It would be very inexpensive to outfit it if you could get it detached from the body and build it into a training center, or build a shell around it and use it for training undercover. There's a lot of different ways it could be done, and less expensively, I think, than building one from scratch or purchasing a dedicated training facility. And it lets people train in a real environment. You know, we all learn to do things in a classroom where there's plenty of room. We got tables that are at the perfect height. Why don't we use our ambulance trainers, and we can actually learn what it's like to be working in the cramped quarters of the back of an ambulance. What a great idea. I urge you to check out this article that talks about exactly how they are going to be implementing the training here at Indiana University, and I think it's a great idea. So check it out, and it's just another way people are innovating and bringing real simulation with patient care into the training environment. I'll move along to a story that is not quite as upbeat as the last one, but I think it is a cautionary tale for all of us to keep in mind as we move forward. And in fact, the final three stories here in the news all have a similar theme of making sure we are doing things in a correct procedural way and covering ourselves appropriately for difficult calls. The first item that falls into that category is an article I found from Denver, and it has to do with an ambulance that was transporting a patient on I-25 in Colorado, and a woman that was involved in the transport in the back had a history of suicidal tendencies and suicide attempts, and she actually got off the cot and opened the back doors and jumped out onto the highway as they were heading down the road. We've had stories like this show up in the show before. I believe another time it happened was in a Florida ambulance. Something similar to this happened. And the family has predictably filed suit against the crews involved as well as the ambulance company. And they're citing that given the woman's prior history of suicide attempt, that there was not enough care taken to properly secure her in the back of the ambulance. The report in the article says that the woman pulled her legs out from under the strap across her lower legs and undid the buckle of the strap across her waist and chest and got up, sat up on the stretcher, and then jumped out the back of the ambulance while it was moving down the road and subsequently died. You know, I'm not second guessing the crew at all because, you know, I don't think that you can predict when someone is going to do something like this. And I'm not sure, given the current thought process on physically restraining patients in the pre-hospital and hospital environment, I don't think that there was probably a whole lot these people could have done, even if they could have predicted something like this would have happened. Unless you were going to know for sure that she was going to be of danger to herself, there was probably no way to get a medical order to physically restrain her to the cot. And so this is just an unfortunate situation. I would say, though, that if you have a patient that you suspect is going to hurt themselves and maybe even hurt you in the process, you need to maybe ask for some additional assistance and additional help. Contact your supervisors and let them know the situation. Tell them that you believe the patient's a danger to themselves and you're not comfortable transporting this patient on your own. This is one of those things that you're going to be too late if something happens. You can't second guess this one. You've got to go ahead and go with your gut. Read your patient histories before you begin transport. If you have a patient that has a history of dangerous psychological action, you need to find out exactly what they've done in the past. And you also need to contact medical direction, your supervisors, and the hospital if you're doing an interfacility transport so that you are adequately prepared to help out transporting this patient. And that may involve bringing along another provider in the back, making sure that the patient keeps their seatbelts on at all times, setting up a signal with your driver to make sure that they know if you say a key word that they are to immediately pull over to the shoulder of the road. And this all can go a long way to maybe alleviating something like this happening to someone else. And again, I want to stress here, I am not second guessing these providers. If they had thought this woman was going to be a real danger to herself, they would have taken other steps to prevent something like this happening. But unfortunately, people who are psychologically not intact for one reason or another don't think the way a normal person thinks. And so what occurs to them as a good idea is not always going to be what occurs to us as a good idea. And certainly no one else was thinking that, hey, I think I'll jump out the back of an ambulance on a major interstate, because who would do that but a crazy person? But in the meantime, we've got to be prepared for a lot of different eventualities. And this is just a wake-up call for the rest of us, and especially those of you that transport behavioral patients on a regular basis, that you need to have some process to protect yourself from getting hung up when someone decides to kill themselves. Because we are not going to stop a person who's very determined to kill themselves from doing so, especially if it means that you might get dragged out onto the interstate with them. And I'm not sure I'm prepared to do that. So we need to come up with a better way to handle this. And I think that I hope that the company involved has reviewed their procedures for dealing with patients like this, because there's no way a single provider in the back of the ambulance is going to do anything to stop somebody from hurting themselves in this manner if they really want to. And the only thing that you're going to end up doing is getting yourself hurt at the same time. So something to learn, a lesson to learn, and we'll move forward. So what is the next cautionary tale that I'm going to deal with in tonight's episode news? Well, that's going to do with a woman who was at a scene of an accident in Texas near San Antonio, and her injuries were determined to be fatal. And she was draped with a sheet, and the providers on the scene went on to handle the other people there and treat the patients that they other patients that they had. It was not until the medical examiner arrived 2 hours later to remove the body from the scene that the medical examiner discovered that this patient was indeed alive. The patient later died from her injuries at a medical center. And so what does this mean? Well, we've talked about this before on the show, and I have to say that there are some very clear steps to take before I will ever pronounce someone dead at the scene of an accident, okay? Now, I'm not talking about a triage mass casualty situation. If you are the first providers on the scene, if you're the only one there that's got the training to do, you have to triage people appropriately using some triage standard, either start triage or rapid start or fast start. There's different triage programs out there, but they all do basically the same thing. They look at patients with a certain level of care, and they look and see if certain quick interventions can make a change in their status. You know, you separate out your walking wounded, and then you go through and you look at everybody else very rapidly, and you make a quick assessment to see if you can make some quick changes to open airways and make a change to the patient's condition. And then you move on to the next patient. If that's what indeed happened in this situation, that's fine. But as other people and providers arrived, other assistants got there, this patient should have been reassessed quickly to make sure that they were indeed a fatal. And I don't want to second guess. I keep saying that because these are all situations that are teaching us a lesson at another provider's expense, because either an error was made or an unfortunate situation led to a bad thing happening. But either way you look at it, there are some key things you need to do when you have a situation where a patient is being pronounced on the scene. If you have triaged patients and more help arrives, you as the senior provider who has started triage needs to tell whoever the new medical commander is or incident commander is that, hey, I had a patient over there. I think they're priority four, or whatever you call patients who are presumed dead. Another provider needs to assess them and verify my findings, because I did a quick triage and moved on to treat other patients at the time. Okay, you've covered yourself. You want to make sure that that's documented when in your run sheets. You want to make sure you follow up on that and make sure that it's done. So what do you do when you have a patient that's presumed dead? You've got enough providers and you're the guy in charge of making sure that this person's injuries are indeed fatal. Okay, there's some quick and easy things you can do. If you're a BLS provider, of course, you're going to search for a pulse. You're going to assess if the patient's breathing. How do we assess for pulses and breathing? We have these things we carry around our necks. No, I'm not talking about our ties. The things we carry around our necks, you know, the floppy things, sometimes we put them in our ears. These are stethoscopes, folks. They can be used to assess for heartbeat. They can be used to assess for lung sounds, okay? Even if you don't have your stethoscope with you for some reason, you get down there, you open the airway, and you look, listen, and feel. Where have we heard that before? Look, listen, and feel is what we do in the very beginning of CPR. We make sure they're if they're responsive or not, right? We call for help if there's no help already on the way, and we go ahead and open the airway and look, listen, and feel to see if they're breathing. If you have somebody you've presumed dead, I recommend you look, listen, and feel for at least 30 seconds. At least 30 seconds. And then I want you to go ahead, get your stethoscope out, and I want you to listen over the apical heartbeat area of the chest, and I want you to listen for a heartbeat for a full minute. Okay? That's if you're a BLS provider, okay? You can also assess for carotid pulse, but you want to do so for a long time. And you can actually listen for a heartbeat and assess for a carotid pulse simultaneously, okay? This is what you need to do. If you've listened for a heartbeat for a full 60 seconds and you've heard nothing, then you can be pretty sure as a BLS provider this patient is indeed dead. I can almost guarantee you no one listened for a heartbeat on the woman that was left for dead in Texas. Okay, there's just no way. If she was alive 2 hours later to be transported to a medical center and later died of her injuries, then she had a heartbeat. It may have been bradycardic. It may have been irregular, so as not to be easily found. Her blood pressure may have been low, so she had no brachial pulse or radial pulse or femoral or even a carotid pulse, but she still had a heartbeat because she somehow was perfusing something to still be alive two hours later. So the way we solve this is to go ahead and listen to that heartbeat. Okay, so that's BLS providers. And this is something I'm going to do as an ALS provider as well. But I'm also going to use my other stuff that I have in my bag of tricks, okay? BLS providers, you can use your AEDs to hook up and see if there's a rhythm. It may be a shockable rhythm. If you get a shockable rhythm on the monitor, well, then this patient is clearly close enough to being recently dead to warrant having CPR started on the patient. Okay. If you're an ALS provider, daggone it, get your heart monitor hooked up to this patient and assess in multiple leads that they are indeed in asystole. Okay. If there's any sign of any kind of organized rhythm, well, then you need to go ahead and follow your protocols and initiate a trauma arrest. And this is because the heart still has a rhythm. That means it's not that long ago that this patient went into cardiac arrest, at least relatively not that long ago. And so these are things we can do to look at things. What else can we do? Well, if you have inline capnography, some kind of way of assessing gas exchange, even the nasal cannula style of capnography device, you can put one of those on the patients and look for a waveform and look at your gas exchange numbers. If a patient was alive for 2 hours, they had to have been ventilating in some way, even if it was shallow breathing, and capnography will show that there is some kind of a waveform going on and some kind of ventilatory effort involved. So again, use the tools you have. They are only as good as your ability to use them. And things like capnography, things like use of a stethoscope, which is just such a basic tool that I don't think we don't practice enough with, and use of your AEDs and heart monitors, all should be used extensively before you ever pronounce somebody as a fatality. Unless they're like missing their head or something, you should be treating everybody as potentially viable until you can prove otherwise and can document so comfortably. So I think I'll leave it at that. This is a lesson to be learned from all of us and to make sure that we don't get into a situation where we've got to try to justify our actions in a situation like this. Okay, so what else could happen that I need to provide a cautionary tale about? Well, we've had the patient who committed suicide and was intending to harm themselves, and we needed to be aware of patient's past medical history. We had the patient who was presumed dead, but not actually dead, and what we need to do to make sure we're covering our own butts. What else do we need to watch out for? Well, when you have motor vehicle accidents, situations where you have an unknown number of passengers in a vehicle, you need to at least make a minimal level of assessment about how many patients were in that vehicle. You know, what is the first thing we do when we get to the scene? What is part of that initial assessment, that scene size up? You know, we get there, we do our scene size up. We go down the list of things. What is the mechanism of injury? What kind of additional resources do I need? How many patients do I have? Okay, that's one of the first things we need to think about. If you see a car with four seats in it, you need to assume there were four people in that car or more until otherwise proven to you, okay? And I say or more because one of the fatalities I had a few years ago involved six teenagers crammed into a Ford Probe, okay? Six of them. I don't know what my wife had a Ford Probe years ago. I don't know how they got six people into that thing, but they had six teenagers sitting in this vehicle. And unfortunately, one of them died in the motor vehicle accident, and there were some significant injuries in the others. But if I had presumed that there were only two people or maybe three in this small car, how would I have been able to justify if three of them had head injuries, got out and wandered away, or a few of them were ejected into the brush near the side of the road and nobody went and looked for them? Fortunately, they were all right there, but it could have happened to me, right? We need to assume there are more than one patient until we've gotten a verification from the patient involved, or we have gotten a look around the scene, or had other providers, fire officers, firefighters, whoever else you've got there, police officers, walking around and verifying there were no ejections, there was nobody else in the car, according to bystanders. And also, we've searched the vehicle. And that's what comes up in this particular story as I finish up this week in the news. It's from Los Angeles, and it is authorities investigating the fact that a 72-year-old woman involved as a passenger in the front seat of a motor vehicle accident was not found until the car got to the police impound lot. She had somehow been covered up in the wreckage in the motor vehicle. Her son was driving the vehicle and was removed and extricated, but nobody realized that there was another person in the front seat. She was covered up by debris and by the airbag, and she had most likely, according to this news story, died on impact. But that doesn't take away from the fact that nobody noticed that she was even there. So this, of course, is spurring all kinds of investigation and looking into in Los Angeles Fire Department, and rightly so. But again, it comes down to you need to have a high index of suspicion until proven otherwise that there's more than one patient whenever you have a motor vehicle accident involving a vehicle with more than one seat. And even on a motorcycle, I would presume that they had somebody hanging onto the back until proven otherwise, because you want to know if a passenger was ejected from any vehicle that's involved in an accident, or somehow trapped in the vehicle in such a way that they could not be found. So anyway, that's enough of these cautionary tales. And heck, you know, I've talked so much about them, that'll probably serve to be a bit of the tip and trick of the week this week. Okay, not really the tip and trick of the week. Consider those extra tips and tricks of the week. Extra little tidbits of things that I try to do when dealing with difficult situations, and things that I think other providers should be working on doing as tips and tricks of the week in order to avoid getting yourself into a sticky situation. So consider those a few extras that I can throw your way. What I'm going to cover for this week's tip and trick of the week is going to be looking at the Glasgow Coma Scale. One of the things that I talked about with listener Kelly, who had emailed me a few different times over the past week, and I actually spoke to her on the phone about some of the things that she was asking me about. But one of the things she said to me as a comment about listening to the show was that as an EMTB, she sometimes felt really over her head in some of the things that I talked about. And I want to make sure that I'm serving my whole listener audience, because as a paramedic, as a nursing student, sometimes I get into things in my schooling and in my knowledge base that may be, at least at this point in your careers, a little bit over your head. So I want to make sure that I'm making things attainable and reachable and understandable by everybody. And I think we can also focus on getting back to basics for all of us, for the ALS and the BLS providers. So I'm going to be trying to focus on at least once a month a real basic skill that all of us should have under our belts to help us in patient assessment, in patient treatment, in general patient care. And one of those things is the Glasgow Coma Scale. It's a real simple device that gives you another method of assessing your patients over time. And the reason I say over time is because just like vital signs, a single Glasgow Coma Scale is only going to give you a quick snapshot of one brief moment in time. It doesn't tell you how the patient was 10 minutes ago, and it may not tell you much about how the patient's going to be 10 minutes later, but it can be a way for you to look at the patient's assessment over time. And so this is another one of those trending tools that gives you the ability to make an assessment about the patient's condition now, and then use it to verify the effectiveness of your treatments or to verify the improvement or deterioration of the patient's condition over time. So the Glasgow Coma Scale is a great way to assess the patient's level of consciousness and general responsiveness. We all learn our AVPU scale, right? Are they alert? Are they alert to verbal response? Are they alert to painful response? Or are they unresponsive? And those are some really basic ways to look at things. The Glasgow Coma Scale takes that a step further. And I think it's a great tool for us to use in assessing patients who are unresponsive for a variety of reasons, as well as in general trauma assessment. The Glasgow Coma Scale assesses three attributes of a patient based on a sliding scale of a top number of 15, which means they are fully alert, conscious, and oriented, all the way down to 3, which either means a deep, unresponsive coma or a person who is dead will also have a GCS of 3. And it assesses three attributes: the patient's eyes, their verbal response, and their motor response. And you can think of it as eyes, verbal, motor, 4, 5, 6. And that's because those are the top scores in each of the categories. Eyes, a score of 4, 3, 2, or 1. Verbal, a score of 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1. And motor response, a score of 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1. So let's start with the eyes. The eyes are really simple. The eyes are, do they open spontaneously? Okay. When you walk up to the person, do they open their eyes and pay attention to you? Now you need to kind of pay attention to the patient's baseline. And a person who is blind may not notice that you're approaching, but they still should have some eye movement and should in other ways be alert to your presence. If they don't open their eyes spontaneously when you approach, and of course that would be a 4, then they would move down in the scale. Are they opening their eyes in response to your voice? Are they opening their eyes in response to a painful stimulus, or do they not open their eyes at all? And so you can think of the eyes kind of like the AVPU scale, right? Alert, verbal, painful, or unresponsive for the eyes, okay? They open their eyes spontaneously, it's a 4. If they respond to your voice, you call their name, and they open their eyes and look at you, that's a 3. If you have to do a painful response, like a sternal rub or pinching the nail bed, then you go ahead and give them a painful response, a score of 2. And of course, if they don't open their eyes at all, no matter what you do, it's a score of 1. You move on down to the verbal scale. This starts at a 5. And this is if they're oriented and converses normally. They make sense when they talk to you, right? They know what day it is. They know who they are. They know where they are. They know what's happened. They are able to give you a history, right? That's a 5. If they're alert and talking to you, but they seem somewhat confused or disoriented, maybe they're alert to person and place, but not time. These are all things you can use to assess. And that would be a score of 4. If they're completely out of it, but they are talking, they're uttering inappropriate words, but they're not making any sense, they're not conversing with you and exchanging at all information, then that's a 3. And if they're just making incomprehensible sounds, that's a 2, and no sound at all is a 1. Assessing the motor response to a stimulus is the last portion of the Glasgow Coma Scale and has to do with a level of 6 or lower. So 6 is going to be they obey your commands. You ask them to grip your fingers and they do so. You ask them to touch their nose. It can be just about anything, but they are actually obeying your commands. If they are not obeying your commands, you can move on down to assess their response to a painful stimulus. And there will be several possible responses to this. Number 5 on the coma scale would show that they are indeed localizing the painful response. This means they're trying to move your hand away. They bring an arm up to brush away the sternal rub. They are reacting and localizing the pain on the body by trying to move their hand to stop you. The second part, or level 4, would be that they don't try to brush your hand away, but they try to move away from the painful response. They maybe you're pressing on their nail bed and they pull their arm back. They don't try to push your hand away with the other arm, but they pull away from it. That would be flexion, movement away from the painful stimulus. If you move on down, it becomes abnormal flexion to pain. This is also called decorticate posturing. This is where the person is actually flexing their internal rotation of the shoulder, their pronation of the forearm, flexion of the wrist. It's a decorticate response. The way I remember this is decorticate, core, to the core, okay? They're pulling in towards the core of the body in response to a painful response. A painful stimulus. And then 2 would be extension to pain or decerebrate response. And this is a movement away from the body. And the way I like to think about these two things is if you think about it, they are still trying to localize the pain. They're pulling in to avoid the pain. It would be abnormal for somebody who's having a sternal rub to push their arms away from the body, right? That is the worst thing, okay? That's showing signs of severe brain injury of some kind. This is not a normal response to pain. And then finally, no response to pain. They don't move. They don't do nothing. They just lay there when you give them a painful stimulus. And this would be a level of 1. So there you go. Those are the 3 things you assess and how you assess them: eyes, verbal, and motor response. And remember, 4, 5, and 6, you're going to assign a number to each assessment, which you can do very rapidly. Then you do the addition, which some of us may not be able to do as rapidly. Amazingly enough, I cannot do addition in my head very easily. I actually have to write the numbers down. So you guys may think I'm some kind of a genius because I do this podcast, but one of the reasons I do this podcast is to help re-educate myself and continue to be frosty in my skills. And I'm telling you, write the numbers down and do the addition the right way so you make sure you get it right the first time. But once you have the number written down, a number between 3 and 15, what do these numbers mean? Well, as an initial score, as a one-time look at this patient in a snapshot, what is their GCS at this moment? It's going to tell you a few things. It's going to give you a general coma scale and let you know what their mental status is with relationship to a head injury or some other problem. And so you're going to say that a patient with a GCS greater than or equal to 13, so this is a 14 or a 15, is alert and oriented and has minor response to a coma response. And think about how somebody would get a 14. Maybe they didn't open their eyes immediately when you walked up. Maybe they couldn't answer you clearly. They were a little confused. Or maybe they were only localizing the pain. They couldn't obey your commands, even though they were able to talk to you. When you asked them to do something, they couldn't move purposefully to do the job right. These are ways that they're pretty alert, but for some reason, something's not right. You move on down to a moderate problem in coma scale, and this would be between 9 and 12. These are the patients that you really need to be ready to deal with in a proactive fashion with your resuscitative skills. It may mean management of the airway is impending. You definitely want to get these patients oxygen. You definitely want to get ready to treat these patients aggressively because they're either deteriorating fast or they are showing signs of some significant injury or problem with their mental status. And then when you get down to less than or equal to 8, you're talking about patients who have some severe deficiency, some severe problem in their mental status. And so this gives you that snapshot. And one of the things you can do is say less than 8 intubate. If you're an ALS provider, that's an old mantra that a lot of us have used in the field. And depending on your protocols, it may be 8 or less intubate or less than 8 intubate. But this is generally where people draw the line and say, below this point, people are less able to effectively maintain a good airway. So whether you're an ALS or a BLS provider, good airway skills need to be ready to be used in these patients and possibly be ready to go ahead and open the airway and bag these patients to assist with their ventilations as you treat patients who are 8 or less on the coma scale. Then the next part of the coma scale, and this is the part that I think a lot of people miss when they talk about vital signs or whatever. You know, you give one set of vitals and say they're stable. Well, no, stability is a tracked thing. Stability is a status over time. And the same thing goes for the Glasgow Coma Scale. The Glasgow Coma Scale looks at, you can look at them 5 minutes from now. You get there, let's say they're an 11 on the Glasgow Coma Scale. You give them a non-rebreather mask, you get them stabilized in other ways, whether it's giving them fluid boluses or treating a hemorrhage or something, but you go ahead and stabilize the patient, and 10 minutes later, when you reassess their Glasgow Coma Scale, they've gone from an 11 to a 13. You can say, all right, my interventions have improved this patient. They're still not 100%, but we do see some improvement. Now you go ahead and reassess them when you get to the hospital and you pass that information along, and the doctors can see what some of the things might be going on with this patient based on your assessment of the Glasgow Coma Scale. The other thing you can do, of course, is if they were an 11 and now they're an 8, all right, we have a deterioration. Maybe we have an internal bleed. Maybe we have a brain hemorrhage where we have herniation starting. They're starting to get increased intracranial pressure. There are all kinds of things that we could be looking at that could cause this, but this is a slant downward, right? And we need to be more proactive with our interventions with these patients because they are deteriorating despite the fact that we have begun to treat them. And we need to look at other reasons and other causes. So this is a tool that you can use, the Glasgow Coma Scale, to better treat your patients that are having some kind of mental deficiency, some kind of unresponsiveness or lack of good mental status. And you can use the Glasgow Coma Scale to track these patients and trend these patients and be prepared to better treat these patients based upon their score using this assessment tool. That is the tip and trick of the week this week and the last tip and trick of the year for 2007. And rather than cover a med of the week, since I'm already almost 50 minutes into the show, I want to wrap up the year in 2007 with a quick overview and a thank you to a few people that have really helped out the show and where we're looking forward to in the coming year. I want to start off with a few thank yous that go out to some contributors to the show, some regulars that have either sent emails on quite frequently or done some other things. And I'm going to miss a few people here, but I still want to make sure that even if I've missed you, you know who you are, folks. I've mentioned you here on the show frequently, but I'll just try to hit the high points as best I can. And if I miss you, I apologize. Send me an email and I'll be happy to mention you in a future episode because there's almost too many to count, really. This has been a great community effort over the past year. Most of all, I'd like to thank Rick Rosati of the Mitigation Journal podcast. He's a great supporter of the MedicCast. He is always there when I get things together for the MedicCast Live each month. He's found me some great special guests to bring on the show, either on the MedicCast or as a special guest on the MedicCast Live program. Rick's been a great help in many ways. So, Rick, thanks a lot, and I urge you all to check out Rick's podcast at mitigationjournal.com, or you can go ahead and look for Mitigation Journal at the iTunes store and use your favorite podcatcher to download from his site as well. I also want to thank Chris Black. I call him our Alabama connection. He's a paramedic down in Alabama, and he has been great to help out the MedicCast, to propose some things that I implement, including the brand new MedicCast forums. Those were Chris's idea. And Chris, I couldn't do a lot of the things I do on this show without you. You propose ideas for episodes. You have brought things to my attention I was not aware of. You send me news items. You help out in the chat room at the Medicast Live. You've been a guest on the Medicast Live in the phone-in portion. Just so many things you do. And Chris, I really appreciate all of your help. John Bignell of EMS Live has been a contributor in many ways to the show. And I also have to say that he is a contributor to EMS podcasting and medical podcasting in general. He is really the pathfinder. He was out there doing this before anybody else was. And the EMS Live podcast is still a great tool for everybody. And with the new podcast that he'll be opening up over there and the new tools he's made available at the site that just opened this week, I think John is going to, again, take the lead and bring the rest of us along kicking and screaming. So, John, thank you very much. Your support of the show is very valued. A few other folks, Eric Augustus over at the EMS Haiku blog for assisting with the Medicast Live. He calls in even when he's working a 24-hour shift. He will get his cell phone out when he takes a break and call into the Medicast Live. And, you know, Eric, that's dedication, plus your links to the site from the EMS Haiku blog and other things have really done a lot to help out the Medicast. Kenny Schneider in Colorado, he's become a regular guest at the Medicast Live. He's sharing his personal experiences, viewpoints from a long career in EMS and the fire service. And Kenny has just become a great friend of the show, and I can't say enough about Kenny's support. Peter Canning over at Streetwatch Notes of a Paramedic blog, he really sets the standard for written blog content on EMS. He does a lot to make sure the rest of us are keeping our writing skills up to par and shares fearlessly his experiences in the field with us on a regular basis over at his Streetwatch Notes of a Paramedic blog. So thank you very much, Peter, and he's been a guest on the show as well. Finally, two physicians who contributed to the show this year, Dr. Mike of the Pediacast podcast, came on this past fall and talked with us about pediatric sports injuries, and Dr. Will, who is the host of the My Trivia podcast, which has nothing to do with medicine, but Dr. Will is a pediatric anesthesiologist, and he shared information on pediatric airway management with us back last spring. Both of them are also just been of great help to the show, and I urge you to check out their podcasts as well. I also want to thank all of the people that have left reviews over at the iTunes store. I'm going to be listing all of you by your iTunes name that you've signed your reviews with. And if you'd like to be included in that number, you can get done by the end of the year. I'm going to give a thank you publicly on the blog on New Year's Day to all of the people that have their reviews up on the iTunes page for the Medicast on January 1st in the morning. I will be putting up that link that day, and there's 11 people there now. Boy, I'd like to see a whole bunch more. So if you subscribe via iTunes, you can go to the iTunes store, find the Medicast page there, and go ahead and leave your own review of the Medicast. Be honest. You don't have to give me 5 stars, 4 stars, or even 3 stars. Be honest. Let me know what you like about the show. Let the other listeners know what you look forward to with the Medicast. And that way, somebody else that finds the show will be able to use your review to help them decide what they're looking for in podcast content. It's a great way to support the show, and you can get your name up in lights on the blog if you'd like by going ahead on the iTunes review. Finally, there's just a whole host of bloggers who've linked to the show with Claiborne, with the iHeart EMS blog, Dan White over at the Paramedic blog, so many other folks that have contributed to the show. I'll have a list of those as well on January 1st to give them a big thank you. And finally, a big thank you to you, the Medicast listeners. You guys give me information. Share with me your troubles. Share with me the things that you're looking for in an EMS podcast. And I hope that in this past year, I have done something to help advance your career, your schooling, your knowledge here about the EMS field. And I am looking forward to doing some more of that in 2008. I will ask a big favor of you. Share the Medicast with somebody else in the coming year. You're going to have a lot of friends that are going to get new iPods, new Zune players, or maybe a new computer for Christmas. And you can point them to the Medicast site, to the Medicast podcast, and talk to them about the stuff that you like about the show. You can get yourself a Medicast t-shirt and wear it around, and people can ask you about your t-shirt, and you can share with them about the Medicast. All of these things go a long way to supporting the Medicast and getting this information out to a broader audience, and that we all can be better EMS providers in the end. That's really my goal. I want to make myself a better provider all the time. I work hard at it, and I want to take that hard work and share it with you, the listeners. And I want to thank you all for your support. And I've got big things planned for 2008 here at the Medicast. Some new tools, some new things and access for you that if you're interested, you can go ahead and get signed up for when the time comes. And that should be coming up right here very soon in January. If I can get my things lined up, my ducks in a row and everything else done before the new year, school year starts, the new semester at the end of January, I'll be doing that here at the Medicast. All right, enough of that. I'll close out the show and close out the year by giving you some quick contact information and getting on out of here. Contact me by email at podmedic@mac.com. Contact me on the website at medicast.com and leave a comment there. You can also reach me on the voicemail line at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Come back in 2008 for a great year here at the Medicast. I'll wrap up with a great Christmas song by the quintessential PodSafe music artist. I'm talking about Jeff Smith. Jeff is a great supporter of podcasting. He's made a career out of his PodSafe music, and I think Jeff is a great person for me to end my podcasting year with. And so this is his song, My Own Merry Christmas. Check out Jeff's link to his website in the show notes. Let him know you heard the song here on the Medicast. And I guess that's it. I'm going to close out by wishing all of you a wonderful, safe, Merry Christmas, a wonderful, safe, and Happy New Year. I want to hear all of you back here commenting a lot on the Medicast in 2008. I'm thankful for all of the support in 2007, and I'm so looking forward to what's coming. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, wishing all of you a safe and happy holiday. And remember, scene safety, BSI.
The snow is falling down tonight. A carol's ringing through the night this Christmas. The choir right outside your door could be singing one more song for you. If I could join them too, I would. But if there's no other way, then for me to be so far this Christmas, I can write a couple words and a tune. Here's my Christmas melody for you. Go ahead and light the Christmas tree. Go ahead and hang the mistletoe. Go ahead and set another place for me. I will be there in your heart this Christmas. Snuggle close up to the fire. Pretend that I'm watching it with you. Though I'm many miles away, please let my own Merry Christmas find a way to you today. So let me whisper in your ear a thing or two you'd like to hear for Christmas. I'll tell you that I'm coming home, or I'll be there when you carve the turkey, trim the tree. Or maybe that a big surprise will would be to see it in my eyes on Christmas. But if I couldn't make it home, I could send it in a song you could play while I'm far away. Go ahead and light the Christmas tree. Go ahead and hang the mistletoe. Go ahead and set another place for me. I will be there in your heart this Christmas. Snuggle close up to the fire. Pretend that I'm watching it with you. Though I'm so many miles away, please let my own Merry Christmas find a way to you today. Christmas tree. Go ahead and hang the mistletoe. Go ahead and set another place for me. I will be there in your heart this Christmas. Snuggle close up to the fire. Pretend that I'm watching it with you. Though I'm so many miles away, please let my own Merry Christmas find a way to you. Though I'm so many miles away, please let my own Merry Christmas find a way to you today.